You are listening to ListCast. If you'd like to get in touch with us, leave a comment, or perhaps suggest a top 5 list for us to do on the show, you can drop us a line at listcast5@gmail.com or visit our website at listcast.podomatic.com. Now on with the show. Welcome to ListCast. Our show for today is Top 5 Movie Songs. This is the companion episode, which was Top 5 Songs that were vocals. Now we're doing Top 5 Instrumental or Orchestral. Now, in the previous episode, I went first, so Justin is going first today with his number 5.
Okay, and also before we go, much like our Top 5 Death Scenes, for this episode having to do with orchestral themes, we have intentionally omitted anything written and orchestrated by the great John Williams.
Yeah, because it would just all be John Williams.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned in the previous show, my song choices are ones that have staying power, that have been near and dear to my heart for a number of years, not ones that are recent. Mm-hmm. So they've stood the test of time.
All right. My number 5 out of the ones that I'm going to put as my top 5 as opposed to an honorable mention. This is the only one that is not the theme of the movie. This actually just takes place during a scene of the movie. This is from The Karate Kid 2, circa 1986, entitled Daniel's Triumph by Bill Conti. This particular piece of music takes place when Daniel is fighting, I can't pronounce his name, the bad guy in Karate Kid 2. And Chosin is whooping on Daniel, just handing him his ass on a plate. And Daniel is basically falling over a rock and looks up at Miyagi. And Miyagi starts with
the little drum thing.
The little drum with two balls that whip around and clink, 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 make the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's a ritualistic thing because everyone then takes theirs out. It seems like they have a family one. And they all start doing it, rubbing it between their hands, causing the clink clink sound. And it becomes this concussive sound. And Daniel is so inspired, you know, emotionally by this that he finds his inner strength and turns around, looks Chosin straight in the eyes. Chosin goes for a swing, and Daniel beats him to it, and slam after slam after slam. That particular piece of music just gives me chills.
When you said Karate Kid 2, I thought you were going to choose that other moment when Mr. Miyagi is fighting
outside of his house. I thought about it. It's a good scene, but I went with this one just because the scene almost wouldn't work without it.
I think there are very few people who actually appreciate the second Karate Kid.
Really? I find that hard to believe because I think it's in the pantheon of movies where the sequel was just as good, if not better, than the first one.
I don't hear many people mentioning the sequel, although they don't admit that they don't say that it's bad, mm-hmm. but they don't talk about it a lot.
Given the choice between the two, I'd watch 2 every time. I think 2's better. It's a stronger movie. But of course, like Godfather 2, you have to have seen the first one to appreciate it. You know, because that's almost probably why it's so good. It's the second act.
I wouldn't say
it's Empire.
I wouldn't say I agree with you completely on that. I think both movies have parts that work and parts that don't.
But anyway, that's my 5. What's your 5?
My number 5 is from the closing of Heat.
Okay. I have a feeling you'd go there.
It's a song called God Moving Over the Face of the Water by Moby. Now, a little note. This song was actually transformed just a little bit. There's a bridge that they add to the song that isn't in the original version by Moby that actually makes the song much stronger. The song is still fine without it,
mm-hmm.
but without that bridge, it just doesn't feel right. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I know what a bridge is, but I'm not knowing specifically.
There is. The makers behind Heat added a little bit of a bridge to the song. It just...
Was to fit the length of the shot that it takes place?
No. No, just to, I think just to give it a more cinematic feel. Now, this song is good anyway, but it ends Heat so well.
It feels epic.
It does, and I can't imagine the ending of Heat without it. It just fits so perfectly.
But, you know, funnily enough, if I were the filmmaker and I made that movie and someone played for me that song, I would think, that doesn't belong at the end of a cop movie, because it almost has a fantastical quality to it. But it somehow, like you said, it just
works.
Very
ethereal, very otherworldly.
Ethereal. Yeah, that's it.
Do you have anything else from Heat?
From that
movie?
No.
Okay, well, I'll mention, Moby has another song in the movie. I can't remember the name of the song, but it's in the scene when Al Pacino is going after Robert De Niro when he's on the freeway. Right, that's by Moby as well.
That's a good one.
That is another great one, but I had to give it to the end credits because it has a more emotional impact.
It's so aggressive.
It is. But it worked with the scene so well.
Fantastically.
And that song was edited, actually, because the original song, actually, Moby does sing in, but...
Oh, I can't picture lyrics or imagine lyrics.
In the movie, they edited out his lyrics, and it's just the instrumental part of the song.
The instrumental's great.
Oh, it's excellent, but... Okay, we spent way too much time on that one. Now, why don't you go on to your number four?
For my number four, I'm going to go with the main titles from The Untouchables that are entitled Strength of the Righteous Man by Ennio Morricone.
God damn it.
Sorry, man. What do you say about this? This is a badass opening theme. Was this your number one?
No, that was my number two.
Well,
it's just I had a feeling that one of us was going to do The Untouchables, and I wanted to do it.
I had a feeling
it was going to get nabbed.
But
no, let's talk about The Untouchables, man. That theme is fucking awesome.
Another
one of those cases where I remember tape recording the sound from the TV.
Yeah, so did I.
Because it brought so much ass. You know,
it's so good. It's just amazing.
Reused the music from a movie, I think it was called Once Upon a Time in the West.
Right, I've seen it.
From that, he used that theme again for The Untouchables. He recycled that theme.
He created a theme song for each of the main characters. And whenever those characters came on screen, he played their theme. There was one particular guy, I believe this is who you're referring to. one particular guy played by Charles Bronson. He plays a harmonica, and he will often pick it up and do this.
Yeah, that's the Untouchables sound I was talking
not,
about.
Yeah, it's the sound.
It's close.
It's very tonally close. It's not the exact notes, but once you said it, I could hear it through all the tracks in that movie. I knew exactly what you had to be talking about.
Yeah, I don't think I can. I don't have anything else to say about it, but it kicks ass. That's why it was my number two.
So are we on to your four or your three?
I think this is my number four.
Okay.
My number four is one I don't think you'll have on your list, because I wouldn't have thought about this had I not recently rewatched this movie and recognized what a kick-ass theme this is. It's the theme song from Quigley Down Under, written by Basil Poulidor.
I've never got into that movie.
Now, I'm not talking about the movie.
I know, but
I'm not talking about the movie.
I know.
The theme song, can you hear it in your head?
No, because I've never even fully watched the movie.
The movie notwithstanding. I'm talking about the theme song itself. I started this movie, it had been so long since I'd watched it, I'd forgotten the music. This theme song kicks ass. It gets you really revved up to watch an old-time Western-style film.
Basil
Poulidor. He also did the music for Starship Troopers, I believe.
Also for another one of my favorite scores, which is Conan the Barbarian. Excellent score.
Not a movie I think of a score for. But anyway, the theme song from Quigley Down Under. It's a really good, adventurous...
He's good.
He is a good composer.
I think he's
never been an A-list composer.
Yeah.
Not that I can tell.
Although he's done big movies like Starship Troopers or Conan. Those were big kind of in their time.
But he's always been a little under the radar.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Which maybe is kind of...
Now, unfortunately, the theme song is so good and the movie is just so-so.
Right.
But that when I heard that theme song, I got really revved up.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, I'm going to watch a great adventure movie. It has that feeling that you want to feel at the beginning of an adventure story.
Right.
Fortunately, the movie falls a little bit short, but it's still a very good anthem or theme.
Okay, so are we down to my three?
I believe so.
Okay. Debated putting...
Better not take another one of mine.
I debated putting this on there because it's kind of one of those so obvious things, but we almost should have omitted this man's name from the options. Jerry Goldsmith, main title theme from Star Trek I. This main title theme that he did for Star Trek I really became the sound of Star Trek. But this theme, which was obviously reorchestrated for The Next Generation,
won't you please sit down.
You know, The Next Generation, the show, it's a smaller version of that song. When you hear it in Star Trek 1, especially if you can hear it on a sound system blown up and everything, it is a big and powerful song, and it just grabs you right away. And it is epic. It is adventure. It is space.
I had the same reaction to that song at the closing of First Contact.
Yeah.
When they played it.
Yeah.
When you watch it in a theater with a sound system, sure. I mean, it does have a very...
Yeah, because on a theater level, that's probably the first time we heard it. On the big screen.
I don't think so.
Well, they did use it at the end of Star Trek V. You know, this opening in Trek 1, and specifically the way he orchestrated it, because it is different than the orchestration even in First Contact. That original 1979 orchestration of that theme was incredible. Something about the way they recorded music in that time, it just sounds... It has a different texture.
Well, it's almost important to note that song almost didn't come to be. It was written a little differently at first.
You're thinking of the dry dock sequence.
What are you talking about? I mean, the dry dock sequence used that theme.
No, it didn't. You know, I don't really know what else I can say about this. He, throughout the soundtrack of Star Trek 1, he paid homage to Alexander Courage and Fred Steiner, who did the orchestration for the original series. So he did update some of their themes, minor, you know, things, but for the most part, the soundtrack is his. And this opening, it's iconic. Anyway, I'm done. What's your three?
My number three is from Batman 1989.
Okay, debated.
Yeah, it's not the main theme.
Oh, all right.
It's, well, who was the composer on that one, first of all?
Danny Elfman.
Forgive me, Danny Elfman. It's the Batcave sequence when Batman is taking Kim Basinger, Vicki Vale, to
the Batcave. Oh, you mean when he's driving him to driving?
Yeah, it's a very short piece of music. It's probably about a minute and a half.
Yeah, it is short,
but it just
it's got a gothic feel.
It does, but it gives me the chills listening to it every time. I don't even have to watch it with the movie.
No, I know what you're talking about.
It is a very cool piece of music that just fit it so well. The mystery of it.
Yeah.
When he's taking her to the Batcave, you don't know where he's going.
I know, it's haunting.
It is that's a good word, haunting. It is very haunting, and it does have a little bit of a gothic feel to it. I mean, this is a movie by Tim Burton, by the way, but
it really helps you feel what Vicki Vale must be feeling.
Just that piece of music that I recall listening to over and over again when I had the soundtrack album CD,
a good call. Yeah.
Listening to that over and over again just because it was so haunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good choice. Okay, my number two. Okay, my number two, main title theme, 1984, Dune.
Thank you. I figured that was coming.
Yeah, I know. This is an interesting score entirely. Flash Gordon, as I mentioned in the companion episode to this, was a score to a movie entirely done by a rock band. Now, although that movie was a vocal soundtrack. This one was not. This one was an orchestral soundtrack done by a rock band, which...
I still have a hard time believing that.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting because on paper, never having heard it, you would think, what?
It does take you back.
But... And this soundtrack is not loved by everyone. Some people genuinely
dislike it. Well, that
movie
is not loved by everyone.
The movie's not loved by everyone. But I think this is an excellent soundtrack that... I happen to like the movie, but I think it is in perfect tone with the movie. And this opening theme is excellent, in my opinion. It's big. It's got scope. As does the rest of the soundtrack itself. But... frankly, I'm amazed that it wasn't just the band playing the songs. It was, like I said, it was done by an orchestra.
Correct me if I'm wrong. But isn't the main theme the theme that's playing over the scene with the worms at the end when they both climb onto the worm?
No, I'm thinking of the, you know,
that's not the main theme.
Dun 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 dun.
Okay, I got you. Okay, okay.
But of course, the scene with the worms.
I thought that's the one you were referring to. Big battle. There you go.
No, that's not what I was talking about. I was talking about the main title theme.
Well, that's a good one, too.
But the whole soundtrack...
I'm surprised you didn't go with the big battle over that.
You know, I debated, but I felt the main theme really captured the movie. And that's what I was kind of looking for. All right, your number two.
Well, you did take my number two, which was the Untouchables theme.
Oh, that's
theme.
Right.
So
which makes me very curious what you're saving for one.
I don't think you're going to see this one coming, but... For my number two, I'm going to have to mix things up a bit. I'm going to choose the theme of a smaller movie. It's an independent movie called Swimming with Sharks.
All right. I don't even know how that sounds.
I do not know the name of this composer. This song isn't available anywhere, at least not to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very... It's used at the beginning of the film and at the end. It has more impact at the end, but It has a feeling somewhat like a Moby song, where it's very repetitious. But my love for this piece of music is very much tied to my love for the film itself. When I saw Swimming with Sharks for the first time, it was... I can't remember how long ago. Sometime long ago, on cable, late at night, I was up by myself. And this was at a time when I was kind of getting into like independent pictures to see, you know, let's see these kind of...
Right.
You know, alternative to Hollywood. And I saw this movie from with Frank Whaley and Kevin Spacey, kind of weird and dark and funny.
I know you've seen it
kind of funny at the same time. And when you see a rare movie like that by yourself, you feel kind of possessive of it. You know,
right.
you want to tell other people about it. But hey, I discovered this, even though you know you're not the only one. But I mean, it's not John Williams, it's not Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. I don't know who composed this piece of music, but it's just because it was tied to my reaction to this kind of smaller, dark, independent movie. Ending of the movie itself ends on such a down note.
Right.
It's almost... I don't know how to describe it. Let's move on. let's just move on. If you can find the theme song to Swimming with Sharks, I'd check it out. It's very haunting, but you have to watch the movie to go along with it.
All right.
Are we on to your number one now?
We are on to my number one.
Okay.
Which, based on what you said as far as what your number one is, clearly we did not overlap on this, and I'm a little surprised. Buckaroo Banzai, the end title march.
Oh. I didn't... Maybe that's because it's so obvious I didn't think about it, but that is that's pretty cool.
You know, going down looking at my DVD sleeves, thinking, you know, ooh, what about that one? What about that one? I came across this, and it's... This is probably, you know, in my personal history, one of the most rewatched and listened to scenes of a movie.
I think a lot of people can admit to that, just watching that part of the movie. Just,
you know, I don't even know where to begin.
It's not only the song, it's the scene itself is kind of weird.
Yeah.
They're just walking around.
It's the combination that made it work.
Right.
If you listen to the song alone and have never seen the movie or the scene that it plays with, you know, you might be like, it's kind of catchy.
You but, wonder you know. How they would have discussed filming that scene. You know, the director just coming up to the guys. Yeah, we're just going to film you guys walking around, all meeting up this kind of sewer concrete area. And...
Well, I forget specifically, but I do believe that there are other... There was some other movie that was kind of referencing, really? But I don't know what it was. I'd have to...
I'd never heard of that.
I've come across that. But I don't recall what it is. W.D. Richter directed The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
You always have to say the full title.
Well, if, you know, if we're going to talk about it.
Okay.
I don't know what else this man has directed. I honestly don't. The score itself was done by Michael Boddicker. I'm assuming he is also responsible for this end title march. I don't know if he had assistance with it or not, but... It is so damn catchy with this whistle sort of theme that goes... I can't even describe it. It's got a whistle. It's got great music. But like you said, it is played over the visual of all the good guys one by one walking and joining Buckaroo Banzai. Just walking towards the camera and the dead...
Yeah, characters who died have come back
and walking. And again, I know this has been done in another movie before this. You know, this is going to sound weird, but in regards to Star Trek, people have always asked, you know, it's always been kind of whenever you're watching a retrospective on Star Trek, the big question about Star Trek is, why is it so popular? You know, how has it spanned the time? That sort of thing. And my opinion with Star Trek is that it is so successful because you want to be there. You want to be on board the Enterprise. Star Wars is different. Star Wars, you want to watch that world. If you think about it, though, you really don't want to live there because, by and large, it's dirty.
I think a lot of fanboys would disagree with you.
Well, that's if they're the pretty Jedis and all that.
I can think of a lot of people.
Can you imagine being a moisture farmer on Tatooine? That doesn't sound particularly pleasant, but...
Yeah, I've had a lot of fantasies about living on the Enterprise.
Who hasn't? Who's a Trekkie that has not thought about that? It's a world you want to live in.
And what are you getting at? How does this relate to Buckaroo?
What I'm getting at is that those end credits and the visuals that go with it, for me, I want to be with those guys. It makes you, because Buckaroo Banzai, in my opinion, is one of the all-time guy movies. Not because it's a war movie or anything, but because it so taps into the spirit of what it is to be male. And when those guys are walking, even though there's a girl in there and everything, I so want to be with those guys. I want to be a Hong Kong Cavalier, man. It just, I want to be with them. I want to be part of that group. And something about that song and about those visuals that go with it just bring that out. It so nailed it. And it sends you off smiling.
It is a very catchy song that puts a smile on your face. I can't deny that.
And it's a strange song, too.
It is.
It's very
But it's
odd.
Nifty. I think nifty is the way to put it.
Strange, but not, like, out of this world strange. It's just a little off, but in the greatest way. Yeah. So
it always makes me hope for a sequel.
It's one of those things that you end up
I always just
thumping your feet to.
Exactly. It's got a very catchy beat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way to put it. But it always makes me get warm for a sequel whenever I hear that song. I'm thinking, God, that song is so kick-ass even now. If they use that in the sequel or remake, it would still be cool.
Don't change a note. Use it exactly the same way. Yeah.
And did you know, I don't know if you've ever seen The Life Aquatic.
No, you've shown me the end credits.
Where they kind of do a...
They basically did it.
Yeah, they do kind of an homage to it. And being that... the actor, what's his name?
Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum is also in The Life Aquatic, and he walks. I think he does that dip that he did in Buckaroo Banzai. He has this little hop or dip in his step.
Mm.
He repeats that in The Life Aquatic.
That was a I mean that what a perfect way to mention that. You know.
Well, when I first saw The Life Aquatic, when I saw that ending, it pissed me off because
you know it's a rip of that.
You can't have Jeff
Goldblum in it and not know you're riffing.
I knew that, but I'm thinking, does anybody else know what they're riffing? I can't imagine anybody else would know, because Buckaroo Banzai isn't very accessible film.
No, but the creators of The Life Aquatic are in the age group where they would have watched.
Of course, I knew that the people making The Life Aquatic would know that, but most people wouldn't, because Buckaroo Banzai isn't very accessible. It's a very dorky kind of a movie.
Yeah.
But anyway... It angered me because my first reaction to Life Aquatic was negative. I didn't enjoy it. I've warmed up to it since. And so when I saw that, I thought they were taking a movie that I cherished and attaching it to this movie that I just had a very negative reaction to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very upset at first, but not so much.
Yeah, I've tried to watch that like 3 times and I've yet to finish it because I couldn't get into it. But you did show me the end credits. And yeah, I almost had the same kind of guttural reaction. We're like, what? But then as you watch it, first you realize it is an homage. It's done very lovingly. And, I think it's pretty clear that that's what they're supposed to be referencing. And it's done very lovingly, and it's done in good spirit. And it doesn't appear to be mocking it, because how can you mock something that's almost mocking itself?
I see what you mean.
I wish I could remember... what it is. I've looked at things that have talked about what Buckaroo was referencing, but it's neither here nor there. Okay, you're number one. Bring it on.
My number one is Starman, the theme from Starman.
I cannot for the life of me think of what that theme is.
It's played throughout the movie. It's used maybe at least 3 times.
I'm sure if I heard it,
you would recognize it. It's repetitive, just as I mentioned with Swimming with Sharks. It is very repetitive, but it has a very recognizable sound.
Thank you.
my love for this piece of music is because of my love for Starman. I love Starman. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies.
It's and a good movie.
I think it disappointed a lot of John Carpenter fans. It's not usually what he does in terms of film. But I love Starman. I think I've grown a bigger affection for it as I've gotten older. As a kid, I still liked it. But watching it now, and it still holds up. It does have an 80s feel to it. Mm-hmm. But it still holds up to me because it's basically just a road movie.
Yeah, it's a sci-fi movie in disguise, almost.
But the theme is used heavily at the end when Jeff Bridges is leaving.
Gosh, I can almost hear it.
I'm sure you can. Oh, it's probably on the tip of your tongue as he's leaving. And it's a very emotional scene.
Even though I can't remember the notes, I can remember its power.
Right. Yeah. But the actual part of it that affects me the most is they use a part of it in the scene when Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen are kind of just starting off on their road trip, and this is when he still has a gun in his lap,
right?
And she's has obviously the journey just started, so she doesn't trust him at all yet. She doesn't know what's going on, and she says, "You know, I'd rather you just shoot me now, get it over with, than let me go on being scared to death, because this is worse than death." He just picks up the gun, points it at her head. And a lot of this is attributed to his acting ability, mm-hmm. the way he acts. And you think he's going to shoot her. She thinks she's about to die, and he clicks the gun clip, and it just falls out. And they play that little snippet of music, and he says, "I will do you no harm, Jenny Hayden."
God, I want to rewatch this movie.
It's the way it's used in that moment that really hits me. I just love that moment.
I can see it like it was a couple minutes ago. Yeah, I can't hear the theme to save my life, but I can see it.
I believe it was written by, I just looked this up, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, I'm probably butchering it, Jack Nietzsche. I think that's how it's pronounced.
Okay. Niche, maybe?
Nietzsche.
Okay, good. All right, well, I have a couple honorable mentions. Are we good on time?
Alternatives. We're okay on time. Go ahead.
All right, I have the opening main title theme. No, I guess I could say three. The opening main title theme to The Last Starfighter.
I'm surprised you didn't use that one.
I debated. This was done by Craig Safan. A great movie. Again, just one of those things that so perfectly goes
gets you
with
in the mood for the movie.
And, yeah, sets you up. The Last Starfighter was almost supposed to be a poor man's Star Wars. And this theme was... I wouldn't be surprised if Craig Safan was given the directive, give us a Star Wars theme. And in my opinion, he delivered. This is a great theme. It's not as epic.
Big.
But it is big. I mean, it's got a great...
It's not as all-encompassing. I know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain because it is big and it is epic, but it's not...
It's kind of a boyish anthem.
You know, yeah.
Kind
of a, you know. It's almost like a Star Wars theme written by a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting way to look at it. I looked this up. Interesting to note. Craig Safan did the piano theme to Cheers.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an interesting bit of trivia.
Who knew?
Who would have thought that one?
I
thought all those 80s movies, all those 80s TV shows were written by Mike Post.
You would think. Nope. Craig Safan did the piano theme. Craig Safan also did basically Remo's theme in The Adventures of Remo Williams.
I thought about putting that on the list.
I really like the score to that movie. The score is very repetitive because they tend to
reuse... Well, that opening piece of music is pretty kick-ass.
Yeah, they do Remo's theme, and his theme tends to pop up throughout the movie. And it's good. Craig Safan is kind of another one of those, like almost like Basil...
Polidorus.
Kind of a forgotten...
Composer.
Composer, although has really donated some of the more memorable sounds, at least in the movies I've watched. And then lastly, there's a particular moment in the movie, Man in the Iron Mask.
Is this when they're charging to their...
It's almost building death. Two, and then the charge.
What do they say? What does he say? Such virtue or something. Something like that.
The title of this track is Surrounded.
Such courage.
Such bravery.
Something like
something.
That.
Something. This is done by Nick Glennie-Smith, who also did the score for The Rock.
There's a great movie.
As I understand it, the soundtrack to Man in the Iron Mask is actually quite similar
to The Rock.
But fortunately, I've only half seen The Rock, as in I've seen the whole thing, but like with one eye closed and trying to cover my ears so I wouldn't hear or remember most of it. So that could explain why I don't really remember that. But this particular theme was great. And the way he did the soundtrack to this movie, it was a mix of orchestral and a little bit of synthesizer, I believe. A little bit of rock to it, almost. Some people genuinely dislike it because of that, because it doesn't seem like it fits the times, the period of the movie. In my opinion, it kicks bloody ass.
Didn't they do that? Didn't they have like an awkward score to a medieval style piece like that? What's it called? Lady Hawk or something?
Yo, my.
With Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, man. And that is awful.
It had a very awkward score. I remember.
Yeah, that's an example of going way too far.
But that's all I remember about the movie. Didn't fit at all. Score because it was so out of place.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way it felt. I don't mean this to sound like it was that far up, but some people just kind of don't have a taste for it. But I think this particular track is excellent, and it always goes on my compilation discs if I make one.
Well, I didn't have many Oliver mentions. One of them I did have to use, but one I will mention is. It wasn't for the movie. It's a piece of music called The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives. It was used in Run Lola Run. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I've never got around to
it. I saw it once. It was a good movie. It didn't strike me particularly close, but they used this orchestral piece of music written I don't know when by this guy, Charles Ives, who I had no idea who he is. Unanswered Question. Now, the song itself is probably about 10 minutes long, but only about the first minute and a half are good, because he starts using horns and flutes, and it completely ruins the song, at least to me, anyway. But I remember having a real affection for that piece of music, and having a real long hunt to find it, and just to get a copy of it. It was really hard. Maybe that helped in liking it so much. It's a very moving, but very sad, depressing piece of music.
Interesting.
But that's all for me.
Okay.
I'm Josh. I'll see you later. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Justin. Thank you for listening.